Okay, this session is Jody England's session. Jody England Hansen's session called Joseph at Christmas. And our respondent is Jody Hildebrandt. Jody Hansen is a book artist. She graduated from BYU in art. She's the mother of three children. And she claims to have made Jean England a feminist. But he's not here to respond to that right now. But he will be in just a second. Jody Hildebrandt is originally from Arizona. She graduated from BYU, and both of these women have taken classes from Jean England. She is now a University of Utah graduate student in Ed Psych and the mother of two children. After Jody gives her paper and after Jody responds, then there will be questions from the audience, and then I will just ask you two to please repeat the question into the mic so that it will go onto the tape. Please welcome Jody Hansen.
This is a first draft reading. This is my earliest memory. I woke up in the middle of the night, frightened and crying a little. I must have been about two because I was in a crib. I could hear the voices of people talking and visiting down the hall, so my parents were having some kind of party or gathering. I remember standing up and looking at a picture on the wall. There were people in the foreground of the picture with their backs turned to me. They were looking into some kind of shelter or cave. It was quite dark except for a light source that was coming from the inside of a cave next to a pile of straw. There was a young woman in robes sitting on the straw holding a new baby. There was a man kneeling next to her looking at the baby. As I looked at this picture, I felt comforted. I stopped crying, laid down, and went back to sleep. My son Joseph was late, 2 to 3 weeks late, according to the doctor. I felt as though he was 2 months late, but according to Charlotte, my oldest daughter, he was 2 years late. That is how long she had been talking about him. Before she turned four and Anna was almost two, Charlotte began talking to me about Joseph. "Mommy," she would say, "remember when there was a baby inside you and you went to the hospital and got it out and it was a girl and it was Anna?" This was the longest single sentence she had spoken, and it took me a moment to take it all in and respond. "Yes, I can remember that." "Well, I think you should have another baby inside you, and you can go to the hospital and get it out, and this time it will be a boy, and I can have a baby brother, and isn't that a good idea?" I managed to tell her that maybe someday it might be a good idea. She brought the subject up regularly, at least several times a week, to Michael and to me. After a few months, she decided with us that this baby, which someday might be a good idea, would be named Joseph. During the next year, she drew pictures of Joseph and told people I had a baby growing in me and talked about all the things she would do with Joseph after he was born. But I wasn't ready. I knew I would have another baby someday. Childbirth was not easy for me. Recovery from it was long and difficult. We had been restoring a 100-year-old home since Charlotte was a year and a half. She and Anna had grown up around ladders and tools and wire and sheetrock. She liked making little toys out of small pieces of scrap wood more than she liked playing with her Legos. Michael's job as an engineer was very demanding and unpredictable. Our life was just plain hard work, and I wasn't sure if I could handle more. I had known since Anna was born that I would have a third child, and I knew it would be my last. Michael knew it would be a boy. He had known Charlotte and Anna would be girls, so his record was better than the doctor's. I had felt ready for daughters. I wanted baby women that I could love and affirm and validate and empower and teach them to be confident and satisfied with themselves and happy with whatever kind of body they had, and they would know of both their heavenly parents and feel comfort in that, and they would support and appreciate each other as true sisters, and they would know that even though I was their mother, I was also their sister, and they would see me as their best friend, and they could count on me for everything, and I would be able to do this because I had already made all my mistakes concerning these issues, and now I knew it all. I was aware. I am mother. Hear me roar. My first mistake was praying for strong-willed children. I did not want any wimpy little fence-sitters to raise. I wanted them to have strong opinions, and I was so sure it would be easy to teach them to form these opinions carefully. My second mistake was assuming that these baby women would have similar personalities. I figured they would both respond to parenting techniques in the same way, and our unique characteristics would somehow blend perfectly. My third mistake was thinking I would make no mistakes, that I would be such a perfect feminist mother from day one, that my awareness would give me infinite patience and understanding, even in the midst of exhaustion, illness, or normal chaotic family life, and I won't even go on to name the rest of the mistakes. So raising my feminist daughters was not the smooth, affirming experience I thought it would be, but I did feel a unique connection with them that went beyond being their parent. We had been and always would be sisters. I assumed that helped me feel greater sympathy and understanding for them. It was one of the main reasons I felt able to give up many things in my life in order to be a full-time mom. Could it be this way if I had a son? I don't think that a mother's main responsibility is to bear a child and help them to survive with reasonable health until they start school. Even before having children, I believe that the physical nurturing required of a mother was a relatively short period of the parenting relationship. I felt the most important and in some ways the most difficult part of being a parent is the relationship that you begin developing from day one of their life, knowing it will go on forever. I find it fascinating that I could take part in bringing someone into the world, help them become independent adults, and then still want to associate and be friends with them even beyond this life. It was easy to imagine doing this with daughters because I had so many good, close relationships with women. I did not have a good record of successful relationships with men. I'm glad I can count my friendship with my father and my marriage to Michael as successful. I knew I could take a lot of credit for that. So how could I transfer that success into a good friendship with a son? I began to think that if I could raise my son to be a feminist, to really value women as much as men, then it would be easy for us to be good friends. I would pass on my awareness of the problems in society with gender bias and my knowledge of our heavenly parents that they do love us all and want us to become like them in whatever way we can. If he could know of these things, then of course he could grow up with love and respect for all women, especially me and his sisters, and we would always be good friends. Was that the secret to raising a good son? Michael is a good man, and I don't think he had heard the word feminist before I met him unless it was used as a negative connotation. He was raised in an extremely conservative household in L.A. County, California, and there was little effort from his parents to make him aware of social issues, especially the concerns of the civil rights movement and the women's movement. His father worked as an engineer for defense contractors and expected his children to learn to work as well. They were all expected to leave home and be on their own when they turned 18 or start paying him rent at that time. His mother worked hard raising her six children. She volunteered at school and sporting events for both her sons and daughters, and she showed full-time support for her kids. She eventually started her own catering business so she could have money of her own. Michael was not raised with a good example of equal partner parenting, and when I met him, he was in his mid-20s, had been home from his mission for several years, and had not lived at home since he was 19. I was a few years older than he, running my own business, and had been able to travel extensively. I was living in my parents' basement apartment and helped my mother to run her ice cream shop. I had been in several serious relationships. I had learned to care enough about myself to be more aware of men who didn't and not to waste time on them. I decided that I would rather spend my life single than settle for a relationship that quickly became a chore, in which I was working hard to fit someone else's idea of what kind of woman I should be. So instead of worrying about ending bad relationships, I just got better at not starting them. And Michael and I became acquainted through my roommate and were friends for several months before we started dating. He seemed to me as an interesting person, and he seemed to see me as an interesting person, someone he would value as a friend. I never felt he was checking me out to see how well I would fit into his potential mate mode. He enjoyed discussing many things, and this was a big deal to me. He didn't get condescending if we didn't agree on an issue, which had been a real problem with men that I was meeting that were within a decade of my age. He wasn't intimidated by my family, so I began to realize that he had a quality that I valued. He had courage. It took a lot of courage to not be intimidated by my family. Then I went with him to spend some time with his family in California. It was obvious that his mom and I had very different tastes and style, but she was immediately very kind and accepting of me. His father was gone to work most of the day, but I was very aware of the change in the house when his dad was home. He ran the conversation, and no one contradicted him. I won't go into details, but it was very different from what my home was like, and even more different from the home I hoped to have with my husband. But Michael seemed to be living in a separate world from his father. He didn't speak like him, didn't treat people like him, and didn't act like him. I later learned that this was a conscious decision on his part. He knew he didn't want a marriage like his parents. He also knew he didn't want to see or treat others as his dad did, and chose to be different. I knew many people outside his home influenced this choice, but it was still his choice. Marriage to me taught him to be a feminist, at least consciously. It also taught him about great literature, great culture, using Zen in his engineering work, and making things just to be creative. I tell people I taught Mike everything he knows, and he's brilliant. We both learned that overcoming destructive influences of our past, whether obvious or subliminal, takes years of effort, teachability, courage, trust, and love. What did I really teach Michael? I just taught him about things, just as he taught me about things. How he chose to take new knowledge and experiences and become a new person with it says something about the person he already was. He already was a person who wanted to be like Christ. I began to realize, as I thought about having a son, that what I really wanted all of my children to be was Christian, in the truest sense of the word, as Michael was Christian. Christ is the example of how we should see and treat all people. He did more to change the attitude towards women in a patriarchal society than anyone or anything else. And he was a son. Who taught him? Mary had to have been an amazing woman. I can't imagine the faith she must have had to accept the message of the angel and then rejoice over it with her cousin Elizabeth. The scriptures say Joseph was a just man. I think he had courage. It must have taken courage to care more about Mary than how her pregnancy reflected on him. We are also told angels visited him with information about keeping his family safe. I think, even though it says Joseph was visited by the angel, I think it means he and Mary. He and Mary must have been asking and listening, or the angels would not have been heard. Joseph and Mary would have been able to teach Christ well, especially by example. Is this what it takes? Courage and listening. I knew I needed to have courage just as I wanted Michael to have courage. What kind of courage does it take to raise Christ-like children and to be Christ-like? I need to have courage to take care of what is most important first. If I want to raise these children to be my friends, then I can't worry about possible disapproval from society or church members or neighbors or family members about how much of my time and effort is spent on those relationships. And to illustrate what I mean, I want to stress that this is my situation. I can't say that this is how it would work for everyone. I'm an artist. I was very much involved in my freelance business and taking consistent master classes and working on pieces, and I pretty much set that aside for years. But that was, and it's still limiting how much time I can spend on that, but that was my decision. It was a conscious decision. I didn't feel pushed into it, and that's the decision I made. I have high expectations for my kids, but not so much for accomplishments as for understanding and experiences. I don't think it would be right for me to expect a lot from my children without a great deal of support and participation from me. That means a huge amount of time and consistent attention from at least one parent, with much better results if it comes from both. Michael has learned to take time with his kids, to make time with his kids a much greater priority, and has had the courage to risk being fired from jobs that kept him away from his family for unreasonable amounts of time. I was surprised at the pressure I got from all sides about the time I was spending on my kids. I remember seeing some friends here at Sunstone, and they had a small child too, and she openly criticized me for not working outside the home. And a leader in my ward assumed that since I was a stay-at-home mom, I had all the time in the world to just do whatever he needed me to do on short notice. He would really get upset if I wouldn't take on any assignment he gave me at the last minute. And there are many ways that this has occurred, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with that. Others who wanted me to teach or organize would suggest that I really needed to take more time for myself away from my kids, but it always seemed to mean that what they wanted me to do was spend time doing what they wanted me to do for their organization or class. And it takes time to build up this kind of courage, but now it is easier for me to say no to things that infringe on parenting time, and I don't feel like I need to explain or apologize anymore. And my kids know that. They know, I hope, that I'm not going to apologize for putting them as a very important in a very important place in my life. They also know that I have to have my time for creating and making things, and I want them to see that and remember it when they need it themselves. One of the hardest things for me to deal with is the way so many people will diminish the things that we work so hard on. My children all play Suzuki piano, and this system requires a parent to be involved in the lesson and practice time with the child for years before the child will be completely independent of this kind of support. This investment has meant a huge payoff in the confidence and ability of my children with the piano as well as many other things. But each time they have performed at church or at school, someone has come up to me and said, "You are so lucky to have children that are born with such natural ability. I wish my children were that talented." This refusal to recognize that great things can be accomplished by anyone who works hard enough is becoming a convenient way for many to excuse themselves into an average level of mediocrity. It takes courage to keep this attitude from making me apologize for what my kids work hard at doing well. What is really hard is not saying something rude or sarcastic, but how can I ask my children to be Christ-like if they hear me say to another parent, "Oh, I'm sorry, your kids aren't talented. You really should work on that." I don't say it. I think it, but I don't say it. I need to have the courage to love my children. I assumed it would be easy for me to love my children no matter what the circumstances. My love for Charlotte and Anna did not diminish when I was frustrated or upset with them. It grew as they grew. But I didn't realize how hard it is to completely love someone who is so vulnerable. Anna was 3 when I was pregnant with Joseph. She suddenly developed pneumonia and had to be in the hospital. She wasn't responding to treatment the first day, and the doctors were concerned for her recovery. And the pain and terror I felt at the possibility of losing someone that I love so completely was overwhelming. She was able to recover, and I loved her more, but I was almost afraid to think of loving another child so much because there was this possibility of loss. Then when I was 7 months pregnant with Joseph, I was on top of a 12-foot ladder painting the stairwell. And I know that was a stupid thing to do. The ladder tipped out from under me, and as I fell, I could only think of the baby. I managed to twist, so I landed on my hands and knees. I was cut and bruised, but mostly terrified that I had hurt him. Then I realized that I already loved him completely. I let myself feel that love for him, even though it can be frightening, because the alternative would be an emptiness that could only be worse. And I have met mothers that have not allowed themselves to love their children because they're afraid of what they could lose. And it is an emptiness. I recently took a class from a woman who teaches doll making as an art and also as a form of therapy. Her name is Eleanor Peace Bailey. The moment I saw her, I knew she was an amazing woman. She's almost 60 years old. She has an unapologetically ample shape. She has short, straight, dark hair that was tinted maroon the first time I saw her, and green the second. She makes these large, bright, can't possibly begin to describe, these patchwork jackets that she wears everywhere. She travels all over the world teaching her classes, and she collects these amazing one-of-a-kind dolls and attaches them to her jackets. It looks like a number of fantastic creatures are kind of climbing and perching all over her. She joined the church when she was college age and came to Utah to go to BYU. She met and married her husband there, but they chose not to live in Utah. She said, "The Mormon culture in Utah is so powerful it can be overwhelming if you are not very strong and secure as an individual. I knew I needed to live somewhere else for a while before I could be strong enough to survive as myself in this culture." That was really true. That obviously worked for her. Her faith in the gospel of Christ is rock solid, and she is definitely her own person. She told us about a trip she made to Australia last year for a doll makers conference. In one of the classes she taught someone to give her, someone gave her a small soft doll that they had made of a chubby naked woman. She attached it to her jacket on the shoulder so the doll's sunburned rear end was forward. Shortly after returning home to California, she went to the temple to do sealings. As usual, she grabbed one of her jackets to wear. She has a number of different ones. She didn't realize until she was changing into her temple clothes in the dressing room that she had greeted the temple workers with a little naked, sunburned Australian lady perched on her shoulder. She was glad no one had made a fuss over it and hoped some had enjoyed it. In this doll-making class, she said, "God loves us for who we are, not who we pretend to be. We should do the same for ourselves and each other. I need courage to love my children for who they are." Joseph was an easy baby to love. I quickly forgave him for being late. The week he was born, there was a total eclipse of the sun, and that seemed to bring an almost magical feeling to his coming. Joseph was sleeping through the night before he was a week old. He had a calm, peaceful feeling about him, and he rarely fussed. I had several months of a sleeping, calm baby to enjoy before he stopped sleeping through the night, but he was still so pleasant it didn't bother me. Then when he was 16 months old, aliens came down, sucked his brain out, and replaced it with that of a typical toddler. And he and I have been battling at being best friends ever since. There are many things about him that help me love him through frustrating times. When he was a couple of years old, he would sit in a booster seat at the dinner table and go on with the business of eating while the noise and chaos of our family life went on around him. Without warning, he would stand up on his seat, raise his two fists up in the air, open his mouth wide, and let out a deep-throated, loud, sustained yell. When all of us had stopped whatever noise and activity we were involved in, he would close his mouth, sit down, and start eating again. He did this periodically for a few months. We called it his rebel yell. There was something about it that I could relate to, and I loved him for it. I have a characteristic, Michael calls it a condition, that I think truly creative people all share. Michael calls it horizontal surface illness. It seems impossible for me to keep table shelves or desktops clear of items for any length of time, anything longer than 5 minutes. When Joseph was three, whenever he walked through a room that had piles of papers or books covering the surfaces, he would casually reach up and sweep all the items off, clearing the table or desk. I think there was something about that that Michael could relate to, and he probably loved him for it. Joseph is nine now. Except for the fact that he can drive his parents crazy at times, he is not a typical nine-year-old. Last month, he was chosen to perform in the honors recital for the Utah Suzuki Piano Institute. It is almost as hard to get him to put on his white shirt and black pants for a recital performance as it is to get him to practice wearing anything he wants. His hair never stays combed. He is on the swim team, and the chlorine damage tends to make his hair stick out in all directions, and he seems to like it that way. After I had done the best I could with tucking in his shirt and slicking his hair down with mom's spit, I took him backstage to wait with the other performers and went to sit in the audience. When it was his turn, with hair sticking up again, he walked on stage with a half-smiling smirk on his face and a slight swagger in his walk that seemed to say, "I'd rather be practicing my jump shots." Then he sat at the piano, pulled himself into perfect posture, placed his hands on the keyboard, and played a beautiful rendition of a Beethoven sonatina. When he was done, he stood and bowed from the waist as the smiling smirk returned to his face, and then left the stage with the same swagger in his walk. His teacher later told me that the person sitting next to her had said, "Wow, I never would have expected that kind of music out of that boy." I love him for not being typical. Mary and Joseph listened for the angels' messages. I think God tries to help us, all of us, no matter where we live or what our circumstances. But we can only hear it if we listen. Help can come in many ways, some that I have been aware of, and I'm sure many ways that I haven't. There is no aspect of my life where I have needed more help than as a parent. The times when I have needed the most help and guidance have been the most hectic, noisiest times. It is hard to hear messages when so much noise is going on. What do I need to do to listen? If I remember to listen during the rare, quiet times, no matter where they are, messages have come. What do I listen for? I listen for help. A while ago, I was concerned about the lack of unity with my children and with Michael. We were all very busy doing all these right things. All the kids were doing well in school and on the piano, and they were all on the swim team, and everyone was in good health. And Michael was working his usual 50 to 60 hour a week job, and he was in the bishopric. Other than my callings and being a mom, I was trying to paint the house. This kind of schedule was not too unusual for us, and when we all feel support from each other, we can handle this kind of busyness. But at the time, I felt that we weren't connected. I especially felt Michael and I weren't really in the same partnership. The kids seemed to be mildly frustrated constantly. I felt that Michael was trying so hard to do well at work and trying to help so many people in the ward, he didn't have anything left for us. I was feeling like a single parent. He was missing more and more things that he usually did with me or the kids. I would be open and honest with him about my concern, but he wasn't able to see that there was a problem. One day he asked if I would go to the temple with him and a family in the ward whose son was going on a mission. I asked him to be home from work on time so we could have an hour together to go on a walk before we had to get ready for the temple, and he said he would like to do that, but he didn't make it home until 5 minutes before we had to leave for the temple, and this had been happening for a long time. I was furious, especially when he seemed unaware that anything was wrong. He was planning to go off to have this great experience showing support for this other family. As we drove to the temple, I was wondering how I could go in there feeling this way, and I debated telling Mike that I would just wait outside for him. And then I realized how long it had been since I had had any quiet time to ask and listen for guidance, and I needed some. So I got dressed and went to meet the others in the chapel. I didn't know it at the time, but Michael had neglected to tell me that to meet the ward members in another room. So I waited in the chapel for about 45 minutes. As I sat there, I tried to shut out the turmoil I was feeling, and I asked for help to know what to do. And then in the quiet of those surroundings, I heard two women talking. My eyes were open, and I could see people sitting in the chapel. But I could still hear these women talking. I realized one was my grandmother, who I was named after. She died 20 years ago. The other was her daughter, my Aunt Dorothy B. She died 25 years ago. Beyond my immediate family, I was closer to them than any other relatives. They were talking to each other, and then they were also talking to me. I responded with my thoughts, and they responded back. And it was such a delightful conversation. They were talking about difficult times they had had about it. This meant a lot because they had both been in very difficult marriages and suffered a great deal in them. I asked them what they did when it was so hard, and they said they just had to put up with it. They would call each other to cry about it, and they just felt they needed to endure it. And they told me how glad they were that I did not need to do that, because Michael is such a good man. They said I needed to remind him that no matter how good he was at his job and how much good he did for the ward, it would never be as important as being the amazing friend and father he knew how to be to me and the kids. And they seemed to be so happy for me when they said, "Don't stop trying. You have so much to celebrate together. You will have much more happiness in this life, because both of you will want it together." I was so glad for this gift of grace. It was the help I needed, and it worked. I need to listen for peace. A few years ago, a man who had caused problems in our ward threatened me and one of my daughters while we were at church. It was hard for me to not take it personally. Even though I was just one in a long line of people he had directed his twisted anger toward, a series of events related to this really affected me. I didn't have any problem with my commitment to the gospel, but I wondered if I could take my children to church if I was worried about people like this being there. A few weeks after this happened, I was taking an art class that involved using many small pieces of paper. I tried to lose myself in the process of making these creations. But at night, I still found myself lying in bed, unable to sleep, because of my worry over what others could do to hurt me and mine. One night in my dark room, I pleaded for comfort as I lay in bed. I saw above my face a number of small pieces of colored paper shifting around. They moved around until they formed the image of the face of a man, and then they shifted again to form the face of a woman, and then shifted again to form the face of another man. All three had such loving expressions. When the papers had formed the third image, I heard the sound of one clear note sound. And then I heard the message. You only need to do what is yours to do. The rest is for God. The comfort I listened for came. I have turned to it many times, especially where it concerns my children. I only need to do what is mine to do with them. The rest is for God. Finally, I need to listen for reminders of what being a parent is all about, for connections to another place. It is Christmas week. My son Joseph is 6 months old. I had put him to bed for the night about 20 minutes ago, and now I am standing by his door and I can hear him singing. I do not know this song. It is a song from another life, and I believe he learned it before he came to me. What angel taught you this melody? Is an angel singing with you now? Or was it father and mother? Did they hold you in their arms and sing their love to you in this lullaby, hoping the memory of it would reach beyond the veil? Long before they were mine to raise, my children and I belong to mother and father. So I listen for what connects us to them, hoping we will all find our way.
Thank you, Jody. Is this on? Oh, about that? Am I supposed to take her question? Have questions?
No.
Okay. I am new to Sunstone, and I just met Jody over the phone last night and read her paper and wrote down a few comments as I was reading the things that stuck out to me as being a mom. I have two children, and I am single, and I'm going to school right now. And first of all, I just wanted to make some appreciative comments of the courage that you talked about. And as I was reading through the paper, I kept thinking how that was the main thread that she kept coming back to, and how we as women raising children need to have courage to be ourselves. And it's so easy to get caught up in what other people want us to be. And I think for me as an individual and as a mother, that's probably one of the things that I struggle with the most, is I want to please the people. And it seems like when I do that, I leave myself behind. So that was probably the main theme that I kept hearing as I was reading through this, and it kept striking with me. Excellent points as I was going through here. I was very impressed with her courage that she had to know who she was when she was, I would assume, a teenager on through getting ready to be married. I read that section of her paper a couple different times, and I kept thinking, my goodness, I wish I would have known that about myself. I wish I would have known who I was at that time. It's taken me many, many years to have the strength of self-esteem that I have now, and hope to develop more as I grow older. But I think I would have chosen a different mate, probably somebody more like Michael. So I felt a little envious of you to know that about yourself and know who it was that you would pick as an internal mate. Another point that I really appreciated was that you focused on rejoicing in their accomplishments, and not rejoicing so much in their accomplishments, but giving them experiences and understanding that was something that was important to you for your children to understand, that it was great that they accomplished different things in this life, but the most important things that they could understand is having experiences and how to interact with women and men, and to have that courage that Jody spoke so often about in her presentation. A third point that was tendered to me was the story about the woman with the little lady on her shoulder. I could see myself going in and doing something like that, not trying to get a rise, but wanting so much to be myself. I didn't get teary-eyed. And knowing that possibly the majority of the people that I associate with within the church would not approve of that, but having the courage to truly be who I am and not pretend. And also the other point of that comment was loving others for that same courage. And lastly, the other section of the paper that I thought was that connected with me was when you were talking about having courage dealing with others who didn't agree with how she spent her time. I'm kind of on the flip side where I'm not spending a lot of time with my kids because I'm in school, but it's the same thought, it's the same understanding as far as this is what I need to do with my life right now, and what would be really helpful is to be supported in it. And really the only word that I can think of is courage to continue on with what you think is important for you and for your family and for your spouse. That's all that God wants us to do, is to focus on what our responsibilities are, which, if we have children, are raising good, righteous, Christian children, and loving our spouses as well. And the one question that I had that kept coming to my mind was, I was just wondering, when were you aware of, if you had a son, how you wanted to raise that son? I wasn't aware of it until I actually had the child in my arms, like, oh my gosh, this is a boy, and what am I going to do? Because I have a little girl first. And so I was a little bit worried to have this little boy, not having a male figure in the home, and wanting to, I don't think I would have put the word feminist to it, but definitely that was how I was living my life. I didn't hear that word until I went to school. You don't hear that at BYU very much. So when I had my little boy, I was very concerned of how to raise him, and so I was just wondering if you could comment on that, of when it became apparent to you of...
Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. This is one of the problems with just having the first draft paper. This was one of the things I wanted to try to make a little clearer in the paper, but didn't have time to. I guess the awareness that I would have the son, because I knew he would be a boy. I tried to start thinking about that. How would this be different from how I raised my daughters? And basically through thinking more in depth of how I was raising my daughters, I realized it really should apply the same way to each, that you're teaching them to be good people. And realizing that Michael was a good person, even though he didn't have this consciousness taught to him, it's something that he could choose because of the kind of person he decided he wanted to be. And so I figured the best thing I could do for a son was the same thing I was doing for my daughters, is trying to help them understand what I felt a good person needed to be. And that's where the courage and the listening came in. As far as the individual nature of him, I find that he... You know, his individual nature is who he is, whether he's a boy or a girl. Just like my two daughters are very unique from each other. They, boy, things that work on one of them doesn't carry over. Each one is just completely different. And when I realized that I couldn't raise my daughters in the same way, I had to look at each of them as an individual, I realized, well, that's what I've got to do with the son. And I'm sorry if I didn't want to dwell on all the negative relationships I'd been through before I met Michael. It took me a long time to develop that kind of awareness of the person I was. I was 26 when I met Mike. Been engaged three different times to different men, and some had been really destructive. It was a long, hard thing. I'm just glad I didn't end up marrying some of those people before I found that out. So in that sense, I was fortunate. So, but I didn't go into a lot of details over that part. Didn't need to. Wasn't part of the paper. Did that answer your question?
I just wanted to make one more comment that I thought about quite a bit last night. It's things that I have been, over the past probably 7 years, been formulating in my own mind. And through the help of the degree that I'm in up at the university and the professors that I am associating with, that it's not so important the sex of the child that you're raising. I mean, this is kind of in my own mind. I'm thinking that really the important part is to have them watch a role model, whether it's a mother or a father, treat one another with respect, with dignity. It's not as though every experience you need to make sure you do the correct thing or the right thing. It's a day-to-day living of where you speak with honor of your spouse or just an associate. And when I bring my kids to different functions that I'm at, they know that I will not associate with people who do not treat me with respect. And my children say to me, just last night I was thinking about a story of my own, which kind of related to this topic. I clean homes on top of going to school. And my little girl and my little boy sometimes come with me. And I was working at a person's home who I work with. He is my boss. I work for a dentist here in town. And he's an older gentleman, and he doesn't really enjoy cleaning very much. And so we have made an arrangement where, you know, he'll pay me, and I'll come in and clean his house. Well, I was on my hands and knees one day cleaning his floor, scrubbing, and my children see me in this way often with my own house, but not scrubbing some man's floor, because they know how I feel about, you know, teaching people how to do their own work and things like this. And my daughter got down on her hands and knees with me and just kind of sat there for a while and just watched me. And she said, "Mom, why are you doing this?" And without giving a big explanation as to why I was doing it, that we had kind of made an arrangement, and that, you know, Uncle Bob, as she calls him, doesn't really enjoy cleaning. And she's like, "But this isn't like you, Mom. Why don't you teach him how to clean his own floor?" You know, and I looked at her and I thought, you are exactly right. You're exactly right. So my example through, you know, the years that I've had them, when they saw something that didn't quite fit, she called me on it. And even though she's only six, she really had words of wisdom. So I just wanted to thank you, Jody, for your presentation. And I guess if you have any other questions, then you can direct it towards her. Well, what I did, because she's so young, I think if she would have been, you know, maybe twice the age, I would have explained a little bit more. But I just kind of used his age, and that he's divorced and he doesn't have a mom to take care of him, and that's what I used with with her, because he kind of treats me as though, you know, when I work with him, being a dental assistant, I clean up after him all the time, anyways, and so he kind of treats me as like you were saying, the culture that he was raised in, treated him as he grew up. His wife did for him, his daughters did for him, and here I am a woman, and I am again doing for him. I do that because that's my job, but when I got into his home and I was questioned by my daughter with that, I didn't feel like she was old enough to understand all the implications of what went with it, and so I just used that funny expression of, you know, he doesn't have a mom, and we kind of have an arrangement. But it bothered her to see me like that.
Make a PS to what?
You bet.
The question that was just asked that Jody Hildebrandt just responded to was kind of, how do you get your children to kind of buck a culture? That's a lot to ask. How do you respond when they ask questions that suggest things like that? I think Jody was right to try to consider the age of the child and what they're ready to hear. My daughter Charlotte is 14, and I feel pretty confident saying pretty much straight to her this is a tough thing, and you got to decide if you're going to deal with it. And I don't use the phrase "he doesn't have a mom." I use the phrase in a very tongue-in-cheek way. I say, well, for instance, my dad was saying to me a couple weeks ago, have you got your paper done for Sunstone? I've got mine done. And I said, well, I don't have a wife.
Oh.
And so it's kind of the comment that get real, life goes on, and where this fits is different. And my husband, when he makes his lunch to go to work and he's at work eating it and someone there says, oh, what'd your wife make you for lunch? And he says, I don't make her lunch. She's not going to make mine. And so there's kind of a reasoning process that you start letting them hear from day one, and that is, well, it doesn't make sense to assume that this is someone's role. Yeah, the comment was basically recognizing that it's not whether you're a man or a woman and that's the appropriate thing for you to do, but what is it that you feel like doing, and working to make that what you do instead of just assuming that since you're the man or the woman, that's what you do. Is that what you... Kind of.
I'm very impressed with what you...
The question was wondering if we had comments about the church's... Bob has a concern about, in the Mormon church culture, there seems to be not enough effort to educate young men and boys about feeling and expressing their feelings and respect for women. And my comment on that is I have always been really concerned about any parents who rely on any other organization as the chief resource of education for their children. And I think that should be true of the church as well as schools. I think parents need to assume that they're the ones who need to do all they can to give as much information and knowledge and understanding to their children as possible, and not assume it's going to come from anywhere else. And so early on, I decided I couldn't worry whether the church was going to teach it. That's not to say it doesn't bother me if I don't see good examples through other members of the church and their teachers and things like that. But I don't feel that I should in any way rely on that. And so that's made it a lot easier for me to deal with the fact that it might not be taught in the lessons. My biggest concern as far as the leaders in the church or their teachers go is I want them to hopefully have some kind of a good example there in them. The times I've been most upset is when they come home from church and we say, well, you know, what'd you talk about today? And we do that a lot. We're finding out that that's an important thing to find out. What did you talk about in primary? What did you talk about in young women's? What did you talk about in Sunday school? Because one Sunday, Charlotte came back saying, my teacher says the dinosaur bones were put there by Satan. Well, you know, that type of thing I can, you know, we can hear and address immediately. So I think as parents we need to be aware of that and address it. And if our kids know that we will talk about it with them and that we have strong feelings of our own and want them to think about things and discuss these things with us, then I think they'll get better at picking up good things in their exposure to other members of the church and being able to set aside negative things.
I think we need church education.
Maybe because as hard as it is in doing that with the schools, it's beating your head against a brick wall if you're trying to do it with the church. I've been surprised at the few people I know who actually have some influence that I feel very comfortable with in the education through the church, but it's rare.
Have you got some strategies to deal with
it? Yes, we're going to move to France.
He's not going to leave. We have time for one more question.
I guess my response to that is we're just not going to give up. If Joseph is coming under greater influence that we're more concerned about, we're hoping that what we've done and what we continue to do will come back to him.
Do they have a whole lot less television in France?
Let me put it this way. We don't have a Nintendo game in our home. We do have televisions, but we also know how to cut the cord. So...
Just to respond to your question, for me, and in my own ward right now, I feel like, even though my kids are tiny, I still feel like I have some connection to the boys who are that age, who are 12 and who are going through the priesthood power phase of, you know, receiving the priesthood. And I talked to my bishop, and I talked to the leaders who were teaching these boys, and I do it in a way that I don't threaten them. And I share what I'm learning in school, and I talk about how important it is to talk about feelings, and I try to give them more information. Maybe they don't have that information at the time, so they can, if they agree, they can pass that on to the boys that they're working with. Because I think it, you know, obviously it all starts someplace with one person suggesting an idea, or I tried it this way, it worked. And having somebody agree with it, I mean, you have to have an open mind for a bishop, which I was very blessed to have that in my ward. Through him, it's kind of been trickling down. So that's something that I've been thinking about doing and have done in my own ward.
Thank you for coming.